Good evening. It's Wednesday night, and we're working our way to The Hidden Work by E.J. Gold. We've just started. We're on our third class. However, we're halfway through Chapter 2. So Chapter 2, we've broken into two parts. And the first part of the chapter took a certain slant, and we're going to pick that up again in the second part and see where it goes from there. There's a lot of meat in both sides of it, and Aria and Susan were kind enough to summarize the chapter for us, both parts 1 and 2, and if you go on the website, which is wingsofchaos.com, under The Hidden Work, Chapter 2, you'll see both of their summaries, both of them very dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be referring to those as we go on along as well. So let's get started.
Great.
Okay?
Yeah.
Silverdale here.
Oh, good. Thank you, Silverdale. How's the rain up there?
You know, we've had 2 months of absolutely beautiful blue sky, sunny days, 70-degree temperatures, but today it was rainy and overcast.
There you go. I'm headed up to Portland tomorrow, so I figured the rain must be heading my way. We're going to start on page 10, at the top of page 10, the first full paragraph of The Hidden Work. But M.A., why don't you read the header again of the chapter, and just to get us reoriented.
Okay.
And that's on page 5. Okay?
Right. The Hidden Work. In earlier forms of religious obligation, the whole assembly was aware of its invocational significance and expected to produce through its efforts a shared higher emotion, which would transport it as a single body into higher dimensions near that of the Absolute.
And during the first half of the chapter, what we talked about is what is that like? And what is it like now? Because if these are objective activities, objective expressions, then they're occurring now, too.
Oh, definitely.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we did is we ran through what is the ritual that you bring to this class? What ritual do you bring, and then do you bring forth? That's how we work, and we had some great postings in that, and you can see the log of part one if you want to go there or listen to the class. So we talk extensively about not only that historical societies and historical civilizations, as you said, did it, but guess what? What could we do to achieve that now? And we are doing it now.
Mm-hmm.
Are we doing it in the highest chambers and things like that? That's not our concern at the moment. Our concern to do it is, what can we bring to the table? All right? And we had a great conversation, and some of the comments that were made that in the summary was, it's that we come to this event tonight to give our heightened, undivided, essential attention to the space. Listen to this again. We give our heightened, undivided, essential attention to the space. That's part of what we bring to the space, is our heightened, undivided essential attention. So that's what we do, each of us. Each individual does that. And when each individual does that, then the group can begin to form in a certain way. And then later, our summarizer said, it's a collective group effort. It's a gathering of essences. Okay? So that's what we can do. It's not any particular individual, but it's us as a group together, and that forms the collaborative spirit, working together. That's the thing that's different and unusual. Okay. Now, the second part, so I'm going to start reading just a little bit, and then we'll launch into where we're going to go. Knowledge has been replaced by ritual devoid of significance.
Where are you reading from?
Page 10, first
okay.
complete okay. paragraph there.
Okay.
Objective prayer has been replaced by subjective prayer. If we only knew the ancient use and method of prayer, then we would be able to pay nature for our organic arising. Now, that's a little phrase that we never focus on very much.
Mm-mm.
But in a sense, we're given this opportunity. And as everything, it seems to be in the universe, you gotta pay for your lunch. There is no free lunch. And so we come, what is that? And what token, in a sense, do you have to pay? We'll get into that as the book unravels a little bit here. But, so in our case here, I'm just pointing that out. We're not going to necessarily discuss this idea of able to pay nature for organic arising. During the days of the Sumerian and Babylonian civilizations, they knew exactly how to make real prayer. Those were the good old days. I don't know about that. I mean, we can say that, but I would say that the vast majority of the Sumerians and Babylonians were very ordinary. Very ordinary, as they are, as we are today. There were, as there probably has been throughout, a group that could tap into this objective goal period that we want to get into. Those are the good old days when the knowledge and understanding prevailed. Immortality was not sought after for itself. The question of why man exists, why the Creator made the possibility of immortality for human beings, was tied to the sole purpose of alleviating the suffering of the endless Creator. Is Simon on tonight? Okay. The work is a return to this world because we have compassion toward the Absolute. Because of this compassion, we are willing to take the obligation to perfect ourselves. Endure eternal return, awaken the machine, and allow it to act upon our being as a source of transformation. This is what makes the work different from the Bodhisattva vow, for which one returns to the world form of compassion for all beings everywhere. Do we get this a little bit here? The fundamental difference that this work, it's being introduced here by the author, he's presenting a significant difference there. I asked if Simon is here because I think that's a question. And okay. But I want to, what would that be? Why would that be different? What is the difference in those two? So we have a number of phrases that have been introduced in this one paragraph. Objective prayer and subjective prayer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Compassion for the Absolute and compassion for all beings
all
everywhere.
Beings everywhere.
What a different focus. And then as we get deeper into each of those, we will, it'll knock our socks off a little bit, I think. Okay? Not all
humans. So, David, they are asking for a distinction between the work versus the Bodhisattva vow.
Pardon? Who is?
Both Simon and Jim H.
Yeah, that's the part of the puzzle that you two have to deal with in the chapter that you're going to do. So, do we have a fundamental understanding of what it means to, in a sense, come back and help all beings everywhere. Maybe this is what Mother Teresa was doing in India, right?
Perhaps.
Perhaps she was doing that kind of work. Perhaps educating people, helping with their suffering, their immediate sufferings in a certain way, health concerns, poverty. Is this what is meant by that kind of compassion? Possibly. Versus the concept of this strange phrase, compassion for the absolute. How do we stand, on what pair of shoes do we stand in such that we can even see that? It's fundamentally different. We'll let it unfold a bit. Go ahead.
Well, Jim goes on to say, work is for the benefit of the absolute. Mark Roach says that for me, in a way, all beings everywhere equal the absolute. Plus, I guess the absolute wants the benefit of all beings. So the distinction has been a bit confusing for me.
It's confusing for me, too. It's confusing to the fundamental confusion for me is, what does it mean to have compassion for the absolute? If you think about that for a minute, there's so much implied in that. First of all,
who knew the absolute needed compassion?
Well, that's the first thing. It's like, I thought that the absolute is kind of like God, and isn't God supposed to help us? Isn't that the way it goes?
Yeah, I didn't think he needed any help.
And virtually all prayer has to do with God helping mankind, or more particularly, God helping me get my Cadillac Seville today, hopefully.
God willing.
As they say. So there's something fundamentally different here. There's a different way of thinking about this. And then in the next chapter, paragraph, he goes on to say that not all human beings are able to be willing. My gosh, what a strange turn of the phrase. Able to be willing. Doesn't say able to do it. Able to be willing. What is the nature of compassion, and how is it that compassion arises? Compassion arises when the viewer, in a sense, sees with clarity the need of the object of their observation, and they're moved, they're compelled at that point to help in that way, to perform the work or their task, to assist. But suddenly we have this idea of compassion, the absolute. That's scary. There's something frightening to me about that. It makes me nervous to think about it.
Well, maybe that's the part, are able to be willing, because you run up against that particular barrier.
It is a genuine source of terror for ordinary man that the absolute might need help of any kind. Hence the periodic abundance of available work positions, and that's obvious. And then he goes on to say, the method of voluntary ascension to the cross is no longer known through ordinary means, nor does it survive in initiatism, knowledge passed down through the centuries from father to son and mother to daughter. It wasn't passed on to me. I didn't get that passed on.
No, I didn't either.
Right. Mm-hmm. So we are students and learning to see, what is that? What is it that we're what does it even mean? If I say what it means in a certain way, it doesn't quite matter. But it has something to do with having compassion. And having compassion in part means allowing yourself to see the plight of another, right?
Yes.
So am I willing to see the plight of the Absolute? I can barely even allow myself to start thinking about it, let alone to consider its plight.
I usually think of it in some place of awe and wonder, and rather than a need to be compassionate towards the Absolute. More look at the creation as awe, and it doesn't seem that in that there's a need to help the Absolute. So I've never seen that in other places.
Yeah, and I think that let's take MA's position here for a minute, and let's shake it up if we can.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so she's saying, when I think of the Absolute, if I'm getting that right,
mm-hmm.
I have this feeling of awe. And what is the nature of that awe? What is that? What do you begin to feel at that moment? What is the kernel of the light that is going on at that moment?
It's almost a intentional withering of myself to glorify a higher being.
I don't know about the idea of glorifying a higher being, because at this point I don't think we have the capacity to see big enough such that we can glorify a higher being. But is it the beginning of seeing a higher being where we're struck with awe, we're gasped with awe? And I think by necessity at that moment we're carried out of our, certainly by this time we're out of our own personal little egos.
Mm-hmm.
Our egos and our hopes, desires, and wishes and things like that.
Yeah.
That's gone.
That withering of that particular egotistical, egotistical ideas.
What I have heard some of these people say is that when they get to a point of seeing that, and if they see it much, much more, they are compelled to pursue this. Their life as they know it is over. It's done. Everything then becomes a subtext on this work that we're talking about here. Now, part of the key to this is going to be an understanding what is prayer absolute. We have several chapters and we're going to develop this, but we're just introducing brand new concepts here. So, you know, we've talked about this idea of compassion, objective prayer, subjective prayer, and compassion for the Absolute versus all beings everywhere. Just I'm noting that just so we have it.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Susan, and please go ahead.
Okay, I have a comment from Simon. It says, perhaps we have to first be able to help the Absolute before we can help humanity.
Before we can help
humanity. Okay. So, I'm still stuck on the part, how do we help the Absolute? Because I'm...
We have a few comments on that.
Yeah, go ahead.
Compassion is something greater. The Absolute becomes identified with creation.
Can you say who's saying it also when you get a chance, please?
Yes, of course.
Going forward.
Okay. Jim H. said the compassion needs to be pure and boundless. And then Molly says we can help with that because we are identified as well.
Very good. They're very good. Those are all bang on. They're getting close. This idea of we are identified is going to be huge in a little while as we go through the book here.
Well, Becky asks, the identification with the creation is the same as being unconscious?
No. Okay, what we've been studying, what was the last book? Life in the Labyrinth. Okay, and then before that was Joy of Sacrifice. In Life in the Labyrinth, we're saying, okay, now we're going to live in the world of the essential self. We're going to begin that process. Going from HBM, where we started to study the concept of awakening the machine, to the area of the Life in the Labyrinth where we are now, that's an assumption. Let's see what it's like to be in the essential self. And now, Becky, I think it is, we are, okay, we're going to be there. Now, what happens when we look around? And suddenly, thrown in front of us is this idea of compassion for the absolute. It's not so much not being conscious, but it's living in a different manner. It's living from the point of view of the essential self and imbuing ourselves with that essential self. That's where the fundamental difference starts. So it's living a different life. Okay?
Hawk Lady added that we help the absolute by opening up and allowing the love to pour in and sending it back.
Yeah. We're beginners on this phase of it. Everybody here, I don't know who's on tonight in total, but everybody here are skilled operatives in this work. We've been doing this a long time, and I've said this, so now I'm saying harvest that. You can't run away from that. Hold your position, harvest that position, and acknowledge the fact that that essential self is alive, active, and well in you. Because the next part starts pretty soon, and that's what we're talking about. So if we allow more of this grace to come in, we get, something gets expanded. Then the author goes on, we've made it all the way to page 11. Prayer Absolute, the method of ascension to the cross, was so commonly known by everybody that ancient initiates never thought to write it down. I don't know about that. But let's just say that it existed. Oh, there is perhaps something preserved here and there, now and then, we might happen to discover, if we know what we are looking for. Let me ask, do you know what you're looking for here? Do you, as a group, know what you're looking for? What do you see? Do you sense it when you read something, when you look at something? Do you sense what that is, that you've seen it? I.e., you know what you're looking for? You know what I'm saying?
Might be a taste.
Do you taste it? Do you smell it? Taste it? Mm-hmm. Does it ring right in your ear? Does it feel right to you? I think the answer is yes. And we've established that over the last few weeks, and certainly during Life in the Labyrinth, we discussed that extensively. Some real knowledge preserved in the ritual of contemporary religion. And there is. There's no question that that's the case. And that's why, particularly like in the Catholic Church, there's an enormous distinction between the laity and the hermetic orders, or sealed away in these monastic realms, so that they can just do this. You know, both monks and nuns, they are not in the world at all. Our task, and this is, and I'll remind us of this, is that we are in the world. Can we also not be of it? Can that not be our source? Can we be and source a different place? And I think the answer there again is yes. We must fully realize that praise is not prayer, nor is prayer religion. That's a big sentence, and you have to swallow that, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes on, and I assume that that's a Latin phrase. It is a Latin phrase.
Yeah.
But he goes on to say, to pray well is to work well. So suddenly this whole concept of prayer becomes part of our work. And what is prayer? What does it mean to pray? What, therefore, is prayer? And that's the task of this book. And our work in the next few weeks is to find out, what is it to pray? And Piangio mentioned a particular book, I think, a few weeks ago about prayer. And I want to re-bring up the idea of the Eastern Orthodox and the Jesus prayer. Very simple prayer, and it's, you know, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, and that's it. The mantra, they develop this mantra, and they develop the methodology of bringing the prayer so it is operating from your heart, and as it says in the Bible, it says, pray always. Well, how do you pray if you're, you know, you're selling something at your shop? Or how do you pray if you're talking to your child? How does this prayer continue? How do you pray if you're arguing a case in court? But there must be some answer. There may be an answer, and certain individuals, you know, particularly in the Eastern Orthodox Church, address this issue and indicate they've solved it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
That the one phrase, nor is prayer religion.
Yeah.
Just because you attend a service doesn't mean that you've prayed. So I kind of look at it as that they're two completely separate things, prayer and religion. I see religion as being the outward form of a place, perhaps, or the outward body of it, but that doesn't mean that the people who go there or are a part of that religion, no matter what religion it might be, actually follow the instructions of the religion or know how to pray.
I think that there are great mysteries, and that people go to church, and everybody, all the politicos, chip over each other about saying how much they go to church. It's like, so what?
Mm-hmm.
That's, as you say, that's the external expression of what is being hinted at. But that's okay. That's what people do. We are not of the world in this case. We're looking for something deeper. And that something deeper exists. It does exist there. So we can find some of it. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Let us find that then. And that's our task here.
Well, a comment.
Please.
Simon just added that we do prayer by working a making of ourselves, a making in ourselves. And Jim said,
say that again.
We do prayer by working a making in ourselves.
A making in ourselves?
Yes.
We do prayer by working or making in ourselves.
Right.
Okay.
And Jim answers, yes, we make prayer.
Good.
Becky says that we make a prayer and it won't be answered, and that is number one to accept. maybe.
Good. I don't know about it won't be answered, but I get your sentiment, Becky. Very well put, though.
Adelson says prayer is emotion. It doesn't have to be words. And then Becky adds on, she says, like this, don't expect any returns from the Absolute, just help the Absolute.
Good.
And that's good for, that's it for now.
I was once asked in a sweat lodge that I was at, spontaneously, I mean, I wasn't even part of that particular group, but I was asked the question, what is prayer? In the middle of, and I struggled with it because there's so many levels of external prayer. I'm praying that my dog feels better by tomorrow. I'm praying that my parakeet learns to say what I'm, you know, I want it to say. Or I'm hoping that my job, please, Lord, I really want you to help me with my promotion next week. It's so much that I can do with that. And there's a certain kind of reverence that people put into that sort of a thing. And the reason is they know no better. It's all that most of us know is our external lives. All we mostly know is what's around us. We don't really feel the reality of this inner work. So when someone says, you make prayer, what a phrase. What are they talking about? They make prayer. This is like a whole different thing altogether. And even the great, and some of the great monks, they're praying for God. You know, they're just praying for their own, that they be better servants of God. Hidden away and they're tucked in there is like a little ego thing, like, I'm doing this, I'm pretty good. I really am praying with no ego right now. And it's so good.
Becky mentioned the return.
Yeah.
From a prayer, trying to get a return back from it, and not no expectations.
Yeah, well, I want, you know, if I'm going to pray hard, I want a return on my investment here. Okay? Come on. At least I can be a little bit enlightened or something.
After all, I invested all that time into it.
Maybe I can be like a, how about like a minor saint or something? Okay? So, we're starting to explore a little bit the difference between objective prayer and subjective prayer. And I think we're going to see a little bit unfold next week as well. And he goes on to say that the prayer absolute was well known in Egypt and the temple priests. And their attempts to meet this obligation toward the absolute. Let's underline that and remember that. Their obligation toward the absolute. Right? That's the egg that's going to come out here. It has long been a technique of schools to transmit data by means of food and drink and even through artifacts and monuments, especially charged with a certain type of higher force. What are some examples of that? Can anybody give those examples, please? A couple of examples. I'm going to go on, but I'm still looking for some examples. The force thus transmitted penetrates the whole of the organic biological machine, bringing special knowledge into contact with ordinary information already present in the brain. So listen here. So it's a special knowledge. Maybe we can call it understanding.
Do you have examples when you're ready?
Into contact with ordinary information already in the brain. over a long period of time, even producing real change in the being. Go ahead, Susan.
Well, Becky says the Great Pyramid.
Okay.
And Aria says Akchapele. Pretty butchered. Simon is saying the monuments to the Atlantean warriors of Tuxtla, Mexico. Mark Roach is saying amulets, arrays, beacons, truffles.
Very good. Okay.
I'd like to say is art.
Objective art.
Objective art.
Aria is saying a statue, an Atlantean statue of the Toltecs.
Okay.
And Musical Spark says the truffle shop.
Okay, good. And also a artifact that many of us have either been in contact directly or indirectly with is a being like E.J. Gold. Okay, that's an emanating artifact. All right.
I get it from the group.
exactly. So that's what we talked about last week, is that we are in this emanation. Susan, hold that thought for a minute, okay? Because I want to make another point that will fit into.
Okay.
In some cases, the influence of emanating an artifact, monument, or even a man who has undergone transformation and afterward is a source of higher radiation can produce a small change in someone contacting or passing through the sphere of influence, even momentarily. So the formula here is not you must continue to be in contact with that, does it?
No.
What does that imply, anybody?
Well,
those are. Go ahead, Susan.
Well, you get a certain vibrational contact high, and from people or things, and then you can carry those, especially if you mark the moment and carry that energy.
I was thinking of more like a change in being. I mean, more than just superficial kind of just a charge that you get, you know, but I was actually thinking of a definite change in being that one can get, even momentarily passing an enlightened artifact or an authentic artifact.
We're all structured in the same way. We're all structured in the same way. We all have an essential self and a human biological machine. So what happens if we come in contact with an emanating radiation from an enlightened individual or artifacts or objective art? What happens then?
Your radiation.
Go ahead.
Your radiation rises to meet it as far as it can go.
One thing that begins to happen is we begin to discover ourselves. We discover our own essential self. Silverdale?
Yeah.
Does this part ring for you a little bit?
Yes, it does. Clearly we're all subject to influences. And the higher the frequency, the more likely we are to, you know, like a tuning fork, tune into it. But, you know, really, I only accept this theoretically because I've not ever experienced anything dramatic happening, although I can imagine over a period of time that influence actually does probably take root and produce some degree of change.
So these elements, in a sense, are reminding factors. They remind us of this higher vibratory sensation that we had come in contact, and now we want more and more and more of it. And in a sense, you know, I recall now many of my childhood experiences where these higher radiations and emanations were taking place, and I was so moved by it. Okay. Now, but that's not leaving us there. It's not just, it's saying, that's, you've had that influence. And then the study of the question of these radiating artifacts, monuments, and saints has been dealt with in Visions in the Stone.
You want a few more comments or statements?
Yeah.
Okay, so Arya is saying the radiations of a transformed being implies that the being or person has changed or evolved.
And it implies that the recipient was, what was the phrase again? Able to be willing to accept. Right, Arya? Okay. Thank you, Susan. Next one.
Well, she goes on to say they can carry a vibration that affects us and helps us by cleansing, making it easier to transform through sympathetic resonance.
As I said many times during the Life in the Labyrinth, and I say again now, is remember where we are right now. Mark the space. Because we then can create the trail to get back to this space. Because we are in a higher vibratory sensation this moment than we were 40 minutes ago. So mark this also. Can we get back to this space? Can you get back to it on Friday afternoon?
And there's a couple other worthy comments.
Go ahead.
Arya says that shining our light doesn't diminish the light of others, but opens the doors for others to shine too.
Huge.
And then Jim H. says, presence of saints moves you to higher planes.
Good.
Go ahead.
Okay, if this small change of being, which is to say a new feeling of the beginning arisings of objective conscience produced by contact with a radiating artifact, monument, or saint, is to be of any real use in the sense that it produces the strivings toward the work, note well the next phrase, everybody, it must be added to by additional self-efforts. All right? That's the task that we have before us. We've been given the introduction. We got the introductory course. We got all the tools. We were given our starter kits. Got the video, the how-to videos. You have the instruction manual. Gosh, I think I want to learn to play the guitar. Okay, here's a guitar. Now what?
Okay.
Right? It seems obvious in that case, right? Mm-hmm. But why is it not just as obvious in this case? That's my point. It is just as obvious. It's the same thing. You got to put time and grace. I mean, you know, let's say you take someone like, a great, any of the great cellists or great horn players, you know, like Bird or, you know, Charlie Parker. I mean, these are, you know, Pablo Casals or Yo-Yo Ma.
Mm-hmm.
These people put thousands of hours into the effort.
Oh, yeah.
Thousands of hours. Have we put our thousands of hours? Yet our task is to be in the world but not of it. Okay? To
We put thousands of hours into it, but have we actually been there when those hours are passing?
Sometimes
are
we
actually
have.
Working?
Sometimes we have.
Well,
and acknowledge that too. Go ahead, Susan.
Mark Roach is saying that the seed has been planted. We have to water it.
Good. And so how then do we water that, Mark? What is it that we do? You know, and it goes on to say, those who have a natural aptitude for the work, here we are. It's us. It's each individual. How many people are there? So there's 18 people and there's 3 people. That's who has a natural aptitude for the work. You do.
Mm-hmm.
Can you, acknowledge that,
mm-hmm.
by the way?
Mm-hmm.
Do you acknowledge that, Adelus, Kim? Yeah, you. The reason that it's tough to acknowledge, because there's not that much ego right now in this space, and so when you start to acknowledge that attribute of yourself, you also acknowledge something that has to do with this concept of compassion for the absolute. Oops.
After that, I guess.
Oh, gosh. It didn't seem to go away. I'm trying to erase it from my book. And then he goes on, using the techniques of sacred theater as shaman and ancient priestesses did in their earliest rituals, we can use what little we do happen to show about higher dimensions as a beginning point. In a way, prayer absolute is a form of sacred theater. And we talked about that, I think, a little bit last week about the rituals we bring to it. And like, there's a certain, like you go to pick up this book, if you pick it up in a certain way and you actually start to read it, something happens in you, doesn't it? There's a little nervousness because
mm-hmm.
you're beginning to move into that space. And this is our space of sacred ritual right here and sacred theater. And now that we have this big, we're able to see you also, that you can see us. We have a big screen up here, by the way. And we can see everybody in your bright, shining faces and some of the personal, embarrassing habits that you have. But that's okay. We accept it anyway. Each of us, then, is part of the sacred theater that creates this play. I don't know that, and George, what do you think about this, that next paragraph? Sacred theater is an effective method of penetration into the unknown using special acting techniques to activate higher mental and emotional.
Boy, David, I don't have really that much experience. I know that EJ, you know, has a book, one of the Secret Talk volumes called Movements, and that book really does describe how all kinds of physical and emotional and mental movements combined produce definite postures, and. So I would have a tendency to think, yeah, well, I suppose if we know how to move the various parts of ourselves into a definite posture, like a statue, that we would invoke a correspondence, and these priests and shamans that orchestrated the audience were good at bringing them into a collective posture that invoked a definite resonance with the higher dimensions. But again, this is all theoretical for me because I've not done it myself.
Does anybody else want to take a shot at sacred theater?
Mark Roach does. He says, theater is an invocation, and it is further empowered and amplified by the presence and attention of the audience. So it becomes a big group prayer.
We'll talk more about that and maybe even look at doing some experiments later on as we go through the book. If we have greater being, then we are shown the suffering of the Absolute. Can you read that again?
If we have greater being, then we are shown the suffering of the Absolute.
There's a formula right there. If we have greater being, then we are shown that. What then can you do to increase that greater being? And I know that for some you have techniques that you do and meditations that you work through. Is there a way that you can actively accelerate that in your work with others? Is there a way that you can explode the work you've already done, which is great, into another form of work? Are you ready to go to that next level? Are you ready to go to the next level, or are you just waiting? Is there something that you can throw yourself into? Because once you get to the point of, then we are shown the suffering of the Absolute, game over, baby. At that point, you're compelled. Your life has changed at that point. You are agency. Agency flows through you. There's not a lot of choice then. Gosh, you know, I kind of like don't feel like doing it today. The less help we need, the more we can be given. The less help we need, the more we can be given. If we are concerned with our part in the work and the final outcome of our precious little selves, are you doing this because you want to have more power over others? Are you doing this so that you can excel in some way? Because if that is what's happening, game over too.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, that sand will creep away under your feet and that castle will fall as well. We are concerned with our part in the work, then we do not really belong in the work. In the work, you must take the risk that it may all be for nothing. In the end, we might very well be annihilated, because even after full preparation for the work, there is a chance that we might not be immediately useful to the work. I don't know about that. That's so far down the road that it's, I don't know how to evaluate that part, and it's like, so what? That's what I say to that phrase, too.
Mm-hmm.
Big deal. But if sometime in the future you could be useful, our work necessity would be sufficient to bring us into the work, preserving us for later use. And we were talking about this the other night. If something is meant to be for you, if you have faith in the essential self in a certain way, then let it unfold. But if your objective is power over others or accolades, then maybe something else is that foot here. I don't care.
Or if you're trying to get power over your essential self.
Well,
that's also another
doesn't make sense.
Another place.
Yeah, I mean,
there's trap.
It's like if you use if you Shanghai it for the ego, then certain other things happen. However, we can look at it this way: if we had chosen ordinary life, could we have lived in peace with our ordinary organic destiny? I think everybody here can answer that question, as it was no. As it's we're already dissatisfied. These are successful individuals that are here this evening in their own rights, and yet they've decided, I can't go down that route. There's something more that I need. There's another exercise I need. I need to express my being in a different way. Thus we come forth to be together here. We begin to view these questions deeply. We will come to understand what is really meant by study and education. Ordinary study is simply to hear some interesting esoteric ideas and to be able to repeat them at cocktail parties. Deep study is to focus all one's attention with the force of one's whole being until the data is completely absorbed. So there's a difference between the data, the stringing together of the knowledge base, the stringing together of the knowledge base versus this phrase he uses here, completely absorbed. Doesn't there seem to be a fundamental difference there? And in the summary of chapter 2, part 2, at the end they go, as a class we invoke the higher force allowing us to participate in a reciprocal feeling and exchanging of energies that will produce change for our beings. The energy exchange during the class leaves an accumulated subtle change on the being, allowing us to go a bit further into the work. They conclude, now we are learning to use that energy. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Who wrote that?
That's Susan and Aria.
Oh.
And it's up on the Wings of Chaos. What else you got, Susan?
Let's see. Molly says, the trap is for the creator to intervene at all. Another creation must come about. But I think the angels help with that part, maybe.
Yes, I think so too. And that's why I wanted to modify a little bit what Becky had to say. I don't think that there's so much a worldly response to our prayer efforts, but there's a response. Like the universe starts to reshape. If we can look, if we're in an ordinary space and suddenly we look with our essential selves, it will change. We will see it differently, and then it will see us differently as well. And you'll see changes evidenced in the space around you. So the angels do come forth, but we have to come forth also. We have to make these special little efforts that EJ is talking about. We have been given the hands. Now it's up to us.
So,
okay.
So for me, I think the biggest part of this chapter was the effect of passing through the energy of a person that is more enlightened and
okay.
Just how to use that energy and notice when it happens.
Yes. So that's a marker for you, is what you're saying.
Yes. Well, and just noticing when there's people vibrating on different levels, you have the choice of staying at your level or trying to raise your vibration to match the level. And I think, like with this class, it's a constant choice. Do I want to keep vibrating up there?
Well, you said it in the first summary that you guys did, is like the higher vibratory sensation. Do you bring your essential presence here? Do you come forth with that? In a sense, offering that to into the center of the circle. You offer that, not for your own sake, just because it's an offering to the group.
And I would say to that, yes, as much as possible, but then when I can't bring that, I can get to it through the group.
Okay, so the group becomes a reminding factor and says, oh yeah, now I remember how to get there.
Right.
And then you have the ability to do that and bring that forth into the group. So yes. That's the most excellent. So this limitation on, I bring forth the essential self in my presence as much as I am able to. As much as I am able to. Are we not going to be getting into that a little bit as we go forward?
Well, and Mark Roach said, like the famous painting, The Touch, both God and human are reaching out, stretching towards each other.
And to answer Becky again, is that I think that if we just begin to reach out, I think that the response is great. That reach from the absolute back, it's a corresponding, it's axiomatic that it will occur. Good one, Mark. Anything else, Susan, or are we?
I think we're good here.
Kind of good there, okay. Well, that's it. I mean, we're at about 1 hour now. And I want to thank everybody for coming and the efforts that are made. It's tangible and palpable to me that that's the case. So we'll meet again next Wednesday. Once again, it's 7 o'clock. And we're going to venture into Chapter 3. And we'll see where we wind up. Okay?
Pretty good chapter.
It's a good chapter.
Yeah.
Thanks for helping us out, M.A.
Oh, thanks for having me, David.
It's a lot.
It was a really pleasure to be here.
Good. It's always so nice to have you here.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Susan,
online.
Thanks for your help with the phone, okay?
You're welcome.
Thanks Dave and M.A.
Thank you, George. Take care.